thought sometimes occurs to me about how bitter life will be once we lose things we hold dear. Air we can breathe and water that's clear.
From the heart of the Kootenays, this is the Friends of Kootenay Lake podcast series, Voices of the Lake.
A podcast that'll help you stay informed on concerns around the lake and how those concerns are being addressed and managed.
We're your hosts, me, Camille LeBlanc,
and Kayla Tillipaw, broadcasting from the traditional territories of the Tunaha, the Sinaichkst, the Sohkatnk, and Sealh First Nations. Today we're speaking with Mel Reasoner. Mel is a climate scientist with extensive experience in climate research, consulting, and education. Mel is well known locally for giving lectures and presentations through local programs and conferences. In this episode, we discuss climate change, common terms and notions, the scientific evidence, adaptation and mitigation strategies, historical changes, and future climate projections for both our region and globally. We also talk about youth empowerment and climate politics.
Mel is well-researched, and in our area, he's kind of the go-to person for climate research and community education on climate science. He has this ability to share his knowledge with the average person in a straightforward manner that's easy to understand, while also presenting high-quality climate research. I find that through this conversation and in many conversations about climate change, I go through this similar pattern of fear, frustration, a bit of denial, then acceptance, a little bit of apathy, but also hope at the same time. I find that it's a really emotionally taxing conversation to have, and I think that's why people shy away from it. But these are the same conversations that can inspire us to seek solutions and change, because that's really where the hope exists, are in those solutions. I feel we're so lucky to have local knowledge keepers and educators like Mel around the lake.
The song in this episode is called Blue Pearl of the Universe by Earl Hamilton. The song is described as a look at the world and a call to protect the earth. You can hear more of Earl's stuff on Bandcamp, Earl Hamilton Blue Pearl EP. Thank you so much, Earl. We really love this song.
Every time I get the chance, I go to the forest, take me to the other side.
So Mel, we wanted to thank you so much for taking the time to be here and to have this conversation with us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
What was your last experience or adventure on or around Kootenay Lake?
Well, I've got a little sailboat in Nelson, and I've only had it for a couple of years, and I'm a novice sailor. And I just spent 3 days on Kootenay Lake sailing and sometimes motoring up the West Arm and out onto the main lake, and spent 2 nights out in the boat anchored. So I really had a wonderful couple of days out on the lake just very recently.
That's lovely. Sailboats are like little traveling cabins. They're so awesome.
It's kind of like it's sort of like a summer cabin that floats and moves.
Yes. So awesome. Well, I hope you get to spend a lot more time on your boat and on the lake, and I'm sure you have some great adventures planned. So another, I guess, introductory question is to get you to sort of tell us a bit about yourself and the work that you do.
Sure. My background is in geology, and I actually worked in the oil industry for a few years, a long, long time ago. Then I went back to university to get my PhD, and I was very interested in reconstructing vegetation history and climate history in the Rockies over the last 10 to 20,000 years or so. And at the time when I was doing that, that kind of information was mainly of interest to archaeologists. But it rapidly evolved into the climate change issue, because understanding how much climate has changed in the past and why is a key piece of the puzzle for understanding where we are and where we're headed into the future. So I worked at a university in England, and then I worked with an organization that was hosted by the Swiss National Academy of Science, and had a pretty stressful academic existence. And about 2003, my wife and I looked at each other and said, let's just move to Nelson and be normal. So we tried a small business that didn't work out all that well. That was fine. But for the last 12 years or so, I've been working on and off with the Columbia Basin Trust with their climate action programs. And they've been going around the communities in the basin, doing workshops focused on climate adaptation. And my piece of those workshops has always been discussing, sort of summarizing the science of climate change for local politicians and stakeholders, and sometimes the general public.
Thanks, Mel. For people who don't understand the general concept of climate change, what is it and how do we know that it's occurring?
Well, there's sort of two bits, and these two terms often get confused. You hear global warming and you hear climate change. Global warming is happening. The average temperature of the planet is heating up, and that's not in question. That is definitely happening. And it's happening globally, and it's also happening here locally in the Kootenays. It's happening here faster than it is globally. The planet has warmed about 1 degree Celsius or so in the last 100 years. And in Kaslow, for example, over the last 100 years, it's warmed 1.5 degrees Celsius. And so we're significantly, 50% faster in terms of warming than the global mean. And so that's the global warming part, that is happening. But with global warming comes changes in climate. The local warming is a change, but also there can be changes in weather patterns. There can be changes in precipitation. There can be changes in the number of heat waves and those details of climate. For example, longer, more intense summers, which lead to longer, more intense wildfire seasons. So those are all related to global warming, but there are changes that are, let's say, more finely nuanced, I suppose, is one way of putting it. And for example, one of the things that's been happening, it's quite interesting, is in North America, we've been experiencing in winter, often in February, these Arctic outbreaks that are really extreme. And it sounds counterintuitive, but what's happening is, because the planet is warming, the path of the jet stream has been altering, which is a climate change that's related to global warming. And that more windy jet stream has allowed Arctic outbreaks to occur more easily. And quite often when we had those cold Februaries, there were of notable tweets from the president south of the border saying, what happened to global warming? But if you look at a map of the planet, the planet was, 8.8 degrees Celsius warmer than it was in the 1960s. But there's a blue cold blob right over North America. And it's kind of like the way the jet stream was looping around. It's sort of like somebody left the fridge door open and all the cold air spilled out. It was actually warmer, in the Arctic than it was in North America. So climate change can actually locally, sometimes for brief periods, actually make it colder, which is sometimes hard for people to get their heads around. But what really solves that is when you have a map of the world and you see the average temperature, yes, is still warmer. It's just that the cold air that should have been over the North Pole had slipped down into mid-latitudes.
Wow. I'd like to maybe ask a question that just came up for me while you were speaking. You mentioned the 1 degree difference over 100 years. Now, to I think maybe the average person who might not know a lot about climate change, maybe myself, that might not seem like a lot, but can you elaborate on what that means for us and for ecosystems and that sort of thing?
Yeah, and I think the easiest way to put this in context, it comes from the geologic record, and that sort of related to my opening comments about Earth history being a key part of the puzzle here. We've warmed since pre-industrial, about 1.1 or 1.2 degrees Celsius. So that's, from the late 1800s to present. And the projections are by the end of this century, if we follow the business as usual emissions scenario, and really don't put the brakes on very much, we could end up seeing 4 degrees Celsius warming above pre-industrial. And again, you're right. 4 degrees, one degree, 4 degrees doesn't sound like a lot. You can have 20 degrees or more temperature range in a day. So it doesn't sound like a big deal. However, we're talking about mean global temperature, the average of the whole planet. And a lot of work has gone into looking at how much temperature change globally, that mean global temperature, was associated with the ice ages. And if you go back about 20,000 years ago, 18,000 years ago, we were in the middle of a glaciation. And much of Canada was under 1 or 2 kilometers of ice. It was an ice age. And the difference globally in terms of temperature between the ice age and our current interglacial temperatures was about 4 to 5 degrees Celsius. So when we're talking about mean global temperature, 1 degree, you know, is a quarter of the difference between an ice age and an interglacial. And 4 degrees, which is what we may reach if we don't start to put the brakes on, is roughly equivalent to the temperature change associated going from a full glacial period to an interglacial period, except we're going in the opposite direction. We're going even warmer.
Thanks. That really puts it into perspective. That's a huge change. What evidence do we have to show that the climate change we are seeing today is anthropogenically caused?
Yeah, that's a good question. And you often hear a lot of misinformation about that. But people who study the Earth's climate have got a pretty good handle on it. And we know what influences planetary temperature. And it does tend to be a fairly simple thing. The heat coming from the sun, of course, is the main, you know, the key driver. And we do have a greenhouse effect, and there's no question about that. The Earth would be much colder if it were not for the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. But when we look at the output from the sun over the last 50 years, it's been dropping. You know, so it's definitely the increase in temperature that we've seen over the last 50 years, when it's really been ramping up, it cannot be related to solar output, because the energy coming from the sun has actually been dropping by a bit. And there's a few other ideas that have been floating around that involve cosmic rays and the formations of clouds. But again, the effect that cosmic rays have on the Earth's climate system, it's been going in the opposite direction. And also, if you go back into Earth history and you look at, we do have a really good record of the intensity of cosmic rays that hit the surface, because that's controlled by the Earth's magnetic field. And that, over geologic time, sometimes has flipped around and sometimes has kind of disappeared. And the last time it disappeared about, I think it was about 40 something thousand years ago. In any case, there's a record of that preserved in ice cores, I believe. And the thing is that, yes, there was a huge increase in cosmic rays. We see that evidence in the record, but there was essentially no big change in climate associated with it. So all the natural indicators are either neutral or headed in a cooling direction. And we've been warming substantially. So that's one piece of evidence. The other piece of evidence is that we know that carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas. This has been very, very well documented. Carbon dioxide interacts with long wave radiation. We know this with a high degree of certainty. And we've increased carbon dioxide in the atmosphere by about 40%, between 40 and 45% since the start of the Industrial Revolution. And we know it's coming from fossil fuel sources, largely because we keep very good track of, you know, the amount of fossil fuel that's burned, because, you know, there's a price associated with it. The scientific evidence is very clear that no natural drivers are responsible for the heat that the increase in global temperatures we've observed, and the physics for why carbon dioxide increases is causing the planet to warm is very clear. So it's that piece of the science is pretty much nailed down.
Thanks, Mel. With how much knowledge has accumulated over decades on this issue, and with almost everybody talking about it and so many levels of government, you know, putting out their own studies and looking at all this information, there's just basically so much information out there. And for someone like you, who's been through the data and has done the research, I'm wondering, how does someone like you approach a climate change denier?
Well, that's a good question. And I'm still learning. It has nothing to do with science. It's psychology, and I'm not a psychologist. And for years, I thought if you just show the data, if you just show the information, and basically explain it all, that they would change their minds. And of course, that doesn't work. What I think does work is if you're able to appeal to appropriate authorities. Because people, generally speaking, you know, trust the expertise of their brain surgeons and dentists and so on. Otherwise, they wouldn't go to them. And the scientific community has, there are a number of scientific organizations that are highly credible, like the United States National Academies of Science, for example. And they're unanimous. It's very clear from all of the scientific organizations, the credible ones, that, you know, climate change is real and it's we're causing it. We need to do something about it. But even if you go to industry websites like Royal Dutch Shell, Petroleum, British Petroleum, Exxon, and even if you look at Teck Resources, which have big operations in the East Kootenays locally that are involved in extraction of fossil fuels, they're very clear on their website. They say that climate change is real, humans are causing it, and we need to do something about it. So there are many credible sources, even in industry, even in industries that are involved in the production of fossil fuels, that are now acknowledging that the science is pretty solid on this. And really, then the question comes down to what should we do about it?
Yeah, exactly. I find this issue of climate change and talking about it, it's unfortunate that it is so polarizing when it has such huge implications for all of us, maybe more so in other parts of the world than here. So I appreciate you speaking to understanding that, you know, social aspect of talking about climate change. And there's resources, you know, that exist in these, you know, polar spheres of right and left, or however we're divided in society. So I think that's helpful. And,
you know, it's a real problem these days. And I think it's exacerbated by the internet information that's online, and people do tend to go into their silos. And I just finished reading a book called The Death of Expertise, which was very disturbing. And you do see it. It's not just climate change that's an issue now. So many things have become polarized and politicized.
Yeah, media is such a huge influence and such a huge issue with everything that's going on. I almost wish I could ask you, like, what do you think we should do about the media, Mel? I don't think anybody has an answer to that.
Well, I'd like to see them held accountable. I mean, what happens in science is if you publish a paper that's flawed, fatally flawed, then that paper is retracted. It's basically taken out of the scientific literature, and it's basically publicly stated these conclusions are wrong. They are not supported by the evidence. And it happens in a very small percentage of scientific papers that are published, but it does happen. And I can think of many articles that I've read in the newspaper that should be retracted. There doesn't seem to be any accountability. The media can get away with saying whatever they want, and it can have very, very serious consequences. And, you know, one of the Canadian journalists who I think has done more harm than good over the years is a prominent journalist with The National, with CBC Radio, and a columnist with the Globe and Mail. So in a variety of different media, and basically in about 2009 stated that, well, you know, temperature hasn't gone up over the last 9 years, but carbon dioxide has. So, you know, obviously carbon dioxide isn't causing climate change. And that is so fatally flawed. And I use that as an example again and again in presentations. But that still stands. Those, you know, people, I don't know, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people, you know, heard that opinion. And it was absolutely flat wrong. It was an issue of people being misled by a journalist who did not, literally, simply just did not have the scientific expertise to comment on the subject. He was out of his depth.
Yeah. And, you know, I believe some people, they would read that, and because it confirms their beliefs, they really do hold on to it. And that can be so hard to combat, as you know, as you're a community educator working to educate so many people about the issue of climate change and what it means for our area. I'm wondering if you can speak to what are the primary general differences we will see in this new climate versus the historical climate that we've seen worldwide.
And locally, I think the general trends in temperature are up. We will see warmer temperatures. And the projections are somewhere between about 2 and 4 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. warmer than the 1961 to 1990 base period. Certainly, the mean global temperature is going to warm up, and locally it's going to warm up faster than globally. We're expecting that precipitation will change, with precipitation going up in all seasons, with the exception of summer. Locally, the projections for summer precipitation is for a decrease. I think around in Kazlo, the projections are about 15% less precipitation in the summer. So right there, there's a big red flag. Hotter summers, less precipitation. And we've already seen that our fire seasons are becoming longer and more extreme. And we're dealing with the consequences. What was it? Just 10 days ago, we were, you know, all breathing smoke again. And unfortunately, that scenario is likely to replay again and again in the coming years. So that's one big thing. That's one of my big concerns for this part of the world is we live in a very flammable environment. And with increasing summer temperatures and decreasing precipitation, that, you know, we know where that's going in terms of wildfire. And also with precipitation, one of the things that the models are suggesting is that because the warmer atmosphere can carry more water vapor in it, there's more potential for rainfall when it does rain. So in other words, when it rains, it pours. So we're likely to experience more intense rainfall events. And again, we've seen, well, frankly, you see that all the time. It's almost as though a month doesn't go by where you don't hear a story about somewhere in the world where there's been an intense rainfall event that no one's ever seen before, and there's been flooding. And, you know, it happens all the time. And it's happened here in Kazlo in Kazlo in 2013. There was one precipitation event where in 2 days, it rained what would normally fall on average in 2 months. And, you know, there were consequences. And it was the same storm system that moved through Canmore and then over Calgary and caused those flooding problems there as well. So there's real concern around increasing precipitation intensity. And this has huge ramifications for municipal stormwater systems that are trying to deal with increased rain events in terms of intensity. Something that won't impact us here in the Kootenays very much, but is a huge issue as far as I'm concerned, is that global sea level is creeping up relentlessly. And every year it's just a little tiny bit, but it adds up over time and it seems to be speeding up ever so slightly. And again, all of the physics for why that should happen is very clear. Ice caps are melting at a very alarming rate. And as the oceans warm up, they expand. And there's a lot of infrastructure invested within a few meters of sea level around the world that's at risk. That's a huge problem globally. But warmer winters with higher precipitation, likely what that's going to mean in our part of the world is that in the valley bottom locations, there's going to be more precip coming down as rain rather than snow in the future. And that will definitely have an impact on winter recreation, which is a big deal in British Columbia. And one, you know, with your modern ski areas that have all kinds of fantastic grooming machines, if you have a rain event on your snowpack, it's not that big a deal. You get the groomers out and you can still have, you know, pretty good conditions for people to ski on. But I worry about the heli ski operations and the cat skiing operations where people are paying big bucks to ski champagne powder. And if you get a rain event up to, you know, 2,500 meters in the middle of the winter and it turns it all to mashed potatoes until the next storm cycle, then that would be, I'm sure, not a good outcome for those sorts of operations. Well, anyway, I could probably go on, but those are a few of the big ones in my mind for local changes that we can expect.
It's hard to absorb all of that information. Like I'm stuck on a couple things, like 15% less rainfall in our region in the summertime. It's a huge deficit in rainfall that we could see. Like no snow in valley bottoms. Holy. Going through some of your slides, Mel, I saw some histograms in there, and I was wondering if you might be able to explain a couple terms. One term or concept is increase in mean temperature, and another one, increase in variance.
Okay. When you look at the climate history in terms of mean annual temperature. For any location, you're going to have an average over a period of time. But of course, not every year is that number. There'll be cold years and there'll be warm years. But as you get out to the colder and the hotter years, further away from that mean value, there's fewer and fewer. So if you were to plot up that data, you would get something that looks like a bell or a bell curve. So the bell curve is highest at the mean. Most years are around the mean value, but as you get out towards the hot, cold tails, there are fewer. So you get that sort of bell shape. And then the mean can move, but of course it takes that variability with it. But that's another thing that can happen, and there's some evidence that it is happening, is that the shape of the curve can change. So in other words, you have fewer years around the average, but more extreme years in the cold and hot ends. So that curve, that bell gets stretched out a bit. And there's some evidence that this has been occurring, at least in some locations. And what that means is that you've increased your variability. So when you have a very narrow bell, most of the years are close to the average for that location. So the bell shape is quite narrow. But if you have sort of a flat bell shape and long tails, then you would have a big difference between the lowest values and the hottest values. So more variable. And in terms of global temperature, I think it was global summer temperatures that showed that quite nicely on a global level, that the mean has been shifting towards the hot end. So the mean temperature has been increasing for global summer temperature. But also the curve has been flattening out over time. So the mean is moving and also the variability is increasing. And the long and short of all that is that in the new climate today, you still, because the tails have stretched out, you still have some of the cold weather that everybody remembers from the previous climate, the earlier climate. But because it's stretched out in both directions, you have much more in terms of the hot extremes.
Thanks. I was brought back to statistics class right then. And I think it's good for us to start to understand what these tables and graphs are telling us, mm-hmm. Especially the average person who wants to know more about this shifting average and the implications of that in a scene more extreme events.
One of the problems with the way climate changes is that as the temperatures increase in any given location, you do have that variability. You have a hot year and you have a cold year and a hot year and a cold year. And we tend to focus on those extremes. And when there's an underlying trend in that data, it's hard for us to see it unless we actually plot up the data and put it on a graph and look at it. But when you plot up the data, this is something that I do just about every location I've presented the local climate data at. And you look at the last 50 years, and you see how the climate has been changing over the last 50 years. It's been increasing. And you compare that to the model projections. And the model projections are saying pretty much universally across the West Kootenays and the Columbia Basin for that matter, that by the 2050s, your average year is going to be as warm or warmer than anything experienced in the 20th century in terms of mean annual temperature. It's that big a shift. And you go, wow, that's impossible. How can that be? And then people will go, well, those are based on models. We don't believe models. But if you look at the rate of change that we've experienced over the last 50 years, it's in the same ballpark. All you have to do is extrapolate the rate of change we've already experienced over the last 50 years, and you still get to the situation by mid-century where your average year is as warm or warmer than anything in the 20th century. And you know, often when it's presented that way, then you'll see light bulbs going off in people's heads. And they go, oh, really? Okay, I get it now. The rate of change that we're living through has been, in geologically speaking, extremely rapid. But we just tend to not see it because we tend to focus on the extremes, the hot and the cold years and all that stuff, instead of that underlying trend. And it's really important to look at it that way, because then you see that, A, climate change is something that often, you know, people think is going to happen way off in the future. No, it's already happening. We're already living through a rate of change that gets us to the scenario where you're mid-century, this century, your average year is warmer than anything experienced in the 20th century. We've already lived through the rate of change that gets us there over the last 50 years. And B, you know, the model projections are, you know, they're extreme, but they're not dissimilar to what we've already lived through, what we've already experienced in terms of change in temperature.
That's so interesting. As you were talking, I was remembering some terms that I had learned in my environmental planning education. And the one that I think sticks with me the most, that made me feel the most sad, and I guess despairing for the climate change effects, is this idea of like a tipping point. And there's a couple other terms that we are curious about, tipping point being one, and also positive feedback loops and that climactic domino effect. And wondering if you can touch on what those mean for people who this might be the first time then for them hearing that.
Okay. So positive feedback is something that kind of, you're increasing one thing that causes something else to increase that also increases the same thing. So as global temperatures go up, because we're putting more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, that increases the ability of the atmosphere to carry more water vapor. And water vapor and carbon dioxide are the two big greenhouse gases. So as you're putting CO2 into the atmosphere, loading the atmosphere with CO2, things are warming up. And as a consequence, you end up with more water vapor in the atmosphere, which is also a greenhouse gas. So that reinforces the warming. It makes it warmer. Another example is snow and ice cover and Arctic sea ice. Snow reflects sunlight. So the more it warms up, the less snow cover you have, the less sunlight's reflected, the warmer it gets. And then it could potentially get to the point where, okay, we've cut our emissions. We're not putting any more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. But because all this ice is gone and we've got all this water vapor in the atmosphere, you know, it's harder to go back to that previous state. I think you get the idea with the positive feedbacks. There are things that exacerbate the temperature increase. There are other tipping points. The big ones we're concerned about are once some ice sheets start to disintegrate, you sort of reach a point of no return where you're sort of locked in. And there's some concern that this has already happened with portions of the Antarctic ice cap. And the glaciers are sort of held back by buttresses of ice along the coast, ice shelves. And once those go, then the ice starts to flow faster. And the faster it flows, the more sea level rises and then floats more ice. And there's some concern that we've already passed a tipping point with some portions of the Antarctic ice sheet, and that's going to play out over several hundred years. But the ultimate consequence is that sea level may be several meters higher. There's cities that have been in place at the coast for thousands of years that are going to be in big trouble.
On the topic of the positive feedback loops and the tipping point, I just had a question, not even from our list, but is it possible that we will get to a point where this domino effect that's occurring because of what's currently already in the atmosphere we can get to like a certain level of accumulation of CO2 where climate change will just be completely in its own hands and we have nothing to do to stop it at that point? Like it just exacerbates itself through these domino effects to a point where basically we're screwed.
Well, there have been some people talk about a runaway greenhouse effect and we end up like Venus. That's not likely to happen. But I think it's pretty clear, the longer we wait before we start to reduce emissions, the harder it's going to be to control the climate. And to a certain extent, it becomes less manageable as we continue to load the atmosphere with carbon dioxide. It becomes more difficult. And the real essence of the problem is that carbon dioxide at Earth temperatures and pressures doesn't condense. It stays in the atmosphere, and it's very well mixed throughout the atmosphere. Unfortunately, it sticks around for a long time. So it's a cumulative problem. And even if we were to cut off, you know, production of carbon dioxide today, you know, bring it to zero today, we would still be dealing with the effects of climate change for probably centuries, because it takes a long time for Earth's processes to sequester that carbon out of the atmosphere. And there's a lot of talk about, you know, geoengineering, you know, maybe trying to reflect sunlight to cool things down. I guess there's a lot of thought going into how can we suck carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And in fact, I think with some of the scenarios that are used to provide emissions pathways for the different climate models, you have high emission scenarios and low emission scenarios. And the emission scenarios that keep us under 2 degrees Celsius by the end of the century involve pulling carbon dioxide somehow out of the atmosphere using technology that we haven't really figured out yet. So that's a little troubling. I guess one idea for doing that would be to grow crops that you use for fuel, you know, burn these crops in power generation stations, and then you capture the CO2 coming out of the smokestack and you put it in the ground. That would create energy and it would suck carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And yeah, we can do that on a small scale, but we can't yet scale it up to the scale it needs to be. And there's some big questions about, well, where do you grow all this stuff? Where do you get the water for it? What about food? Things like that. So yeah, I guess there's some concern with this scenario because carbon dioxide does stay in the atmosphere for the long haul, beyond our all of our planning horizons. It's going to be with us. The more we put in, the more difficult it will be to manage. No, it's going to stick with us.
Seems like that's one of the biggest implications about climate change is that we're just so unsure about what's going to happen. And these things are so hard to predict. And I can't imagine how much of a frazzle that must be for climate scientists and people in your position trying to figure all this out. Well, thank you for that explanation on kind of like the global context of what's happening and what could happen. Back to more of a local context. When you're talking to somebody about the work you do and about the knowledge that you've accumulated, is there a specific local like fact, like your favorite fact, like maybe scare factor or wow factor or like something that really gets people like kicked into gear that you like to tell people or bring to the table?
Well, one thing in our part of the world that's really obvious, and I show lots of pictures of this, is that the local glaciers are just getting hammered. They're receding very quickly. And it doesn't take long now on Google Earth. If you got your eye tuned into it, you can see where the ice was 100 years ago. They're called little ice age moraines. There are these piles of debris that glaciers left. You can see where the ice was. And so you can put up historic pictures. Here's a picture of where this glacier was 100 years ago, and here's where it is today. And you can see how the ice has receded. The Athabasca Glacier, you can walk up to the snout of the glacier and you can see signposts where the ice was. And also just by looking at those moraines, once you see those moraines, you can see how much ice has been lost. And, you know, the larger ice fields, you see significant recession in these outlet glaciers, the big outlet glaciers like the Athabasca Tongue. But the amount that's receded relative to the size of the entire ice sheet isn't all that much. It's, you know, several kilometers. It's still, you know, significant. But some of the mid-elevation glaciers around Kootenay Lake, they're gone. You can see where there was a glacier 100 years ago and there's no ice left. There's no glacier. There's lots of good examples in our neck of the woods where glaciers have disappeared. They're just no longer there. And, you know, that does have consequences as well, you know, in terms of things like stream temperature and water supply and the timing of stream flow in streams that are glacier fed that are no longer or will soon no longer be glacier fed. That's one that often gets people's attention that people can easily understand. And it's quite, unfortunately, dramatic.
Yeah, just hearing you say that is really just hit home for me. And I think of all of the people who rely heavily on these surface water sources who live around the lake. I want to know more about, I guess, maybe if there's like a positive side. I feel like people are always digging for the positive side for actions to, I guess, work to address climate change. I want to know, you touched on, I think, a few, but I want to know if a different one pops out in your head. What's your favorite climate change mitigation technologies and solutions that you've come across in your research?
I tend to be more on the, you know, this is what's happening and this is what we can expect in the future, which is kind of on the doom and gloom side. People have referred to me as Dr. Doom on more than one occasion. But this might force us to do things better. There was a cartoon that I remember seeing about 10 years ago in a journal that it was an auditorium with somebody talking about climate change at the front and this long list of positive things that would be beneficial from dealing with climate, like better transportation, cleaner air, energy independence, more livable cities, you know, healthier populations, and all this good stuff. And somebody in the back stands up and says, what if it's all a big hoax and we create a better world for nothing? You know, it's a cute cartoon, but and I think on the optimistic side, yeah, there is an opportunity here to change, but also to do things better. One of the ways to reduce greenhouse gas emissions is to burn less fossil fuels and be more efficient in your energy use, you know. And there's nothing wrong with being more efficient. It costs you less money. And likely the price of fossil fuels is going to only go up. So the less you burn, the more money you save. So there are, you know, actually, I think potentially a lot of really good reasons beyond climate change for finding ways to not put carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And, you know, I do have my optimistic moments when I think, you know, humanity will get our act together and we'll pull out of this and we'll come back with a, you know, better ways of doing things. I hope it happens before we're forced into it. And I hope we're able to do it and with enough foresight that we're able to plan it well.
I really like that idea of what you mentioned about, like, even if we're not doing this for climate change, like, we're doing this to achieve the other goals that we have on our radar. And kind of like that notion of, like, community building, like, at the very least, we'll be community building out of this. So we're getting into some more, like, philosophical questions here. How can we engage and empower youth to do research and take action amid a large population or generation of climate skeptics?
Ooh, that's a tough one. Some of the youth that I know are taking up the challenge and actually doing pretty good. I know a couple of people in high school who are heavily involved in organizing, you know, the local climate strikes and action and getting people excited about change and bringing awareness to the problem. I'm really impressed with many of the young people I've met recently who are really addressing this challenge and don't seem to be afraid. I think they recognize what's at stake. But I wish the kids, first of all, I wish they could vote. And I wish the politicians would listen to what the youth are saying more seriously and take them more seriously. And really it's today's younger generation who are going to have to take the lead and solve this problem.
Yes. Fridays for the Future are doing such a great job, seeing them out on the Nelson Bridge and just every day being out in downtown Nelson. Just, it always inspires me, and they're just so well organized and they are making a huge difference.
Yeah. And in terms of, you know, you're right about the people who, I don't know if you want to call them deniers or dissenters or contrarians, those who are basically rejecting the overwhelming consensus, scientific consensus around this issue. They have undue influence right now. And it's hard to fight. And it's partly what we started off with, related to the way society is becoming more and more polarized, and that polarization being facilitated by modern media. And I don't know what the solution is there. But that's an anchor that's preventing us from moving forward. And it's a real problem.
Yes, I 100% agree. And I see that in traditional media and in social media for sure. A question that came up for me in preparing for this conversation that often goes on in my head. I do a lot of hiking in the area, and I sometimes find myself when I'm enjoying like a beautiful view up at Jumbo, you know, I'm enjoying what I'm seeing, but then I also have this little sense of like mourning for the future of these natural spaces and, you know, the challenges they're already facing and the threat that future generations won't be able to enjoy them. I'm wondering, with someone like you who's been researching this for years, how does doing this work affect how you interact with your local environment?
Yeah, I've seen changes over my life. When I was younger, I used to be pretty eager mountaineer and actually kind of honed in on alpine ice climbing at one point. And I can look at some of the routes that we did back in the 70s where they're not ice, the ice is gone, you know, and it's kind of sad. You can actually, in my lifetime, I've seen the character of the mountains change significantly. And that certainly bothers me, but what really made a big difference for me is my daughter now she's 14. And so having a kid really put this all in a different perspective for me. I'm really concerned about the future we're leaving our young generation. And it becomes very personal when you have a young person that you brought into the world. And it does distress me that we're leaving a pretty big mess for kids to deal with in the future. And my biggest concern is I worry, it does bother me that, you know, the natural world is changing very quickly and there's going to be, you know, some issues associated with that change. But my biggest worry is how humanity deals with the changes. We tend to not, you know, work very well together on big problems, globally speaking, and especially when there are shortages of things, which there could be in the future with more and more people and climate change causing issues. I'm concerned about how that might play out in terms of conflict in the future. And that scares me to death just thinking about my daughter's future.
I face the same implications in my own morale and personally. I have a 5-year-old son, and when I'm having discussions over this issue, that's always the one that I try and bring up is, you know, we're trying to create a hopeful future for our children. Yeah. So thank you for that sentiment. We have one more question for you, and it's a pretty big one.
Okay.
So can climate change be realistically managed through individual action? How much are we depending on policy change and changes in corporations or industry?
Okay. I think there's two parts to that in terms of managing climate change. There's managing the effects of climate change, and there's also managing the cause of climate change. In terms of managing the effects, I think that that's something that largely should be done needs to be done locally. People know their own environment. They know if they can anticipate the changes that are coming in terms of climate, they can take steps now to mitigate the damage that's caused by those changes. And that might be, you know, something as simple as revamping your stormwater system to accommodate more intense rainfalls. So the adaptation side of the question is something that I think is addressed, you know, best locally. But the mitigation side of, you know, reducing emissions, And that's a global problem. And yes, it's important that individuals take action. I'm cognizant of my carbon footprint, and I try to reduce it. And it would certainly help if everybody did that. But that's probably going to be difficult. And what's really required to make a big dent in it is more of a top-down approach. This is something that kind of needs to come from national governments, and international cooperation between national governments. That's where I think the key is. And we've started down that path, of course, with you know, things like the Kyoto Protocol and the Paris Agreement. And I believe that it's those agreements that need to be successful, and we have to find a way for them to work. Unfortunately, I think very few countries are on track to meet their Paris commitments. Certainly Canada, it's looking like we're going to totally blow it. And we came into the Paris Agreement. Our goals were Stephen Harper's targets, which were inadequate. And it was quite funny because they were viewed inadequate by the Liberals when the Conservatives were in power. And that's what the Liberals took to Paris and said, these are our goals. And now the Liberals are following a policy path that's seems to ensure that we're not going to make those commitments. So I don't know what the answer is there, but I think the way forward, what needs to happen in order to really get at the root of what's causing the issues is international cooperation, international agreements, and agreements that have teeth. So there's consequences for countries that fail to meet their targets. But that's a huge can of worms. And, you know, when you sort of watch what happens in terms of, you know, international diplomacy, it kind of makes you shake your head. It's sometimes is not the most intelligent process, it seems. Yeah. So I guess in terms of adaptation, I think that's got to be bottom up, local communities taking charge, anticipating what's coming at them and taking steps now to minimize that damage. But in terms of reducing global emissions, which are causing the problem, we need to get our international act together and start somehow a process where all countries are pulling on the same end of the rope.
Thanks, Mel. We're at the end of our questions, but I pulled something up and you can choose whether or not you want to speak to this. But sure. I remembered I was doing research on politics and I was reading party platforms and mandates and stuff like that. I'm not going to say which party this is from, but this is from a federal as well as provincial party running currently in our country. And I'm just going to read you a little excerpt and I'm wondering if you would want to respond to what it says. Okay, so it says the globalist urban-based climate change movement is powerful because it is based on fear psychology, not facts, science, or common sense. The climate fear lobby will be zealously uncompromising in its efforts to shut down the Western resource-based economy. This is not acceptable and cannot be allowed to continue in the future.
Well, that's a mouthful, and yeah, I can guess which party that is. But to say that it's not based in science is just flat wrong. And this is something that I think the first step that we need to get beyond is the science is very clear. And as we were talking about earlier, we can easily identify credible scientific sources that lay this out in layman's terms for policymakers. That is something that is just patently false, that there's no science behind it. What we do about it is a policy issue. There are value judgments involved, but that increasing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is causing climate change and will cause climate change in the future is very clear scientifically. It is science-based. And that, I think, in my view, is the first key step, is that when people say that climate scientists, the scientific organizations like the U.S. National Academy of Science are misrepresenting the science or somehow getting the science wrong or are not science-based, that just needs to be called out as flat wrong. Once we've agreed on that, hopefully, at some time in the very near future, then we can decide how, you know, what we're going to do about it and how we're going to deal with it. But that's difficult for me to listen to. And that it's espoused freely by, you know, mainstream political parties in this country and other countries is really disturbing. And as a scientist, I take great offense to that. And that's where I will stand my ground. And I can point to the credible scientific sources and demonstrate that that is wrong, period. We're not out to destroy any industry. I think that most climate scientists would like to see energy industries make a shift, and some of them are. I mean, this is something that's just in recent days. I think it might have been on CBC radio, hearing something about Royal Dutch Shell saying that they're starting to shift their focus away from fossil fuels to renewable energies. This would be great if the energy industry could make that shift and find a way to still provide energy for humanity, which we need, but do it in a way that is not loading the atmosphere with greenhouse gases. I think it's doable.
Thank you, Mel, for giving us so much information and doing it in such a way that's accessible and easy to understand and clear. So we've come to the end of our conversation, and this is usually when we sort of give you, I guess, the floor to sort of let us know anything that you want to mention, anything that you're working on that you want our listeners to know about, or any sort of promotions or any plugs that you want to put in.
Well, this is not so much of a promotion, but it's something that I'm involved with a small consulting company, and we've been doing some work for the city of Edmonton I'm working with a guy who is really good at writing code and developing software. And what we've been able to do is converting him into probability of exceeding thresholds with some software that we developed. So a bridge engineer might say, well, my bridge deck is going to fail at 42 degrees. And we can say, well, the probability of that happening before 2050 once is going to be 33% or something like that. So this has been a really fun project to work. It's kind of, you know, again, doom and gloom. We're talking about negative things, but it gives planners some real solid numbers to base their decision-making on and to prioritize their adaptation strategies, because they're able to see what is the likelihood of various failures in their assets, and look at which the consequences of those failures, and then prioritize which one is most likely to happen and has the most consequence. So that's something that I've been having a lot of fun playing with, and working with some people in planning departments has been really interesting, and it's opened up some doors for how communities can address issues of asset management and climate change in a much more quantitative way.
Wow, that sounds like a pretty big undertaking, but really cool and really helpful. And thanks for sharing that, Mel. It's been such a pleasure talking with you, and you've provided a lot of really great information. Like Camille mentioned, that's super palatable for people to understand, and we really appreciate your time.
Yeah, no problem. I'm happy to do it. And and I'm glad that there's folks like you getting involved and finding ways to basically raise awareness of the issue, which I think is a key part of the process.
Of course, we're happy to do it. We're learning a lot along the way, and I learned a lot today. So thank you so much for that, Mel.
All right.
Have a really great rest of your evening.
Okay, you too. Thanks so much.
Thanks again. Bye.
Bye for now.
Thanks for tuning in to Voices of the Lake. As always, you can follow Friends of Kootenai Lake on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for ongoing updates on our projects and programs.
Huge thanks to our funders, the Osprey Community Foundation, the Regional District Central Kootenai, and the Nelson District Credit Union for helping us bring these stories to you.
Again, you're listening to Blue Pearl of the Universe by Earl Hamilton. Check out his stuff on Bandcamp. Thanks, Earl. Take me over the mountain stream, all the love I have.